And be sure and get involved here at KBOO. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member. We need you. We need all the help we can get, and we know you're listening, so it's important for you too. Thanks very much. And KBOO Portland, stand by.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space, the musical, showing March 16th through March 31st on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee, Oregon. Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space is an original comedy musical featuring cheerleaders, rebellious youth, evil aliens, puppets, and fueled by the songs of the 80s. Again, that's Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space, the musical, showing March 16th through March 31st on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today's guest is here to address a particularly crippling issue that she says affects all of us, and that is what she calls the disease or the dis-ease of racism. Leslie Gregory is a certified physician assistant. She founded the nonprofit Right to Health to bring healing to those affected by racism. A longtime Portlander and social justice activist, Leslie writes and conducts research on the health impacts of racism for all Americans and looks at this issue through a clinical and a public health lens. Her focus is on an approach that is humanistic and preventive. And Leslie, I want to thank you for coming in.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Okay, and also on the phone, we have community rights activist Paul Cienfuegos, who will be operating as a guest host with us, and he turned me on to Leslie and helped bring her to the show. So, Paul, are you there?
You betcha.
Okay, great. So just butt in any time, Paul, and because who knows where this is all going to go, but ask a question anytime you feel like it. And I just, okay. And I want to welcome Leslie, and just start with saying I watched a film that was like connected to your website that you had a link to a talk you gave, and you showed the film. It was called Unnatural Causes, and it showed that black women give birth to a disproportionate number of underweight and premature babies. And even when things like poverty and education are like factored into all this, mm-hmm. it's still the case.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's like three times. Mm-hmm. And you know, and the other thing was that it's even like almost three times what it is for a white, a black educated woman and a white high school dropout.
That's right.
And on top of all that, it seems that if a woman comes from Africa and gives birth here, she's mm-hmm. fine. Mm-hmm. But as soon as she's been here a while, she's just dealing with the same stress that African Americans are. And I just wanted you to start by commenting on that.
Right, and we know that that same African woman that comes here, after only a year, the risk goes right back up, like it is for African Americans.
Like three times the rate for white women.
Exactly, and even undereducated white women will have a higher overall health than a black woman who may have a college degree. So what used to be the paradigm around underachievement for black Americans, we now know it's nothing to do with that. It's about that ever-present low-level stress all the time of racism.
Yeah.
And I think it's also very important to include that that low-level chronic stress can also affect white people who are aware of racism in their communities. And so we need to flip the script a bit so that people stop thinking about those poor black people being affected by racism and look at it more as a humanist issue, that it affects all people and in fact is closely analogous to The Matrix. For those individuals who've seen the movie, they understand that there is a false narrative that's in the background of that movie, very analogous to racism.
Right, the false narrative being basically that there's an underclass and an elite class or something like that.
Well, or that there is this pluralistic society in America that's equal for all people.
Oh, there you go.
And then you start to realize in the background that something's not right.
It's not there.
Something's not exactly the way we think it is. And that's the black cat that is a scene in The Matrix where there's a crack in that narrative. And that's where black people live all the time,
right?
Knowing.
So in other words, in this society that's supposed to be justice for all, equality for all, et cetera, et cetera, you're saying that the Matrix thing is that is not true.
It's just not true. Right. We're living in a sort of false reality, Neo, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that's a part of this underlying dis-ease that all of us feel, as well as the fact that we're paying for it.
Yeah.
We know that $2.4 billion a year in sectors, just sectors of the country, not the entire country, just sectors of the country, is wasted on primary care diseases like heart disease, diabetes, these sorts of things that are not being treated in primary care as prevention, but instead people are going to emergency rooms for that. Everybody pays for that.
Right.
And there's a large segment of the population that just does not go to primary care for those reasons. And we know that's another place where that funding is paid for by everyone, not just people of color.
Right.
So we know that these are the sorts of health disparities we can track and show that the disproportionate number of Americans are paying for this. And that's how it affects everybody.
And even like, you know, back to the neonatal thing,
mm-hmm.
It was like I read $68,000 just for a month in neonatal care.
Exactly.
You know, and it's not necessary. I mean, it's like,
yes.
And so let's talk about that again, like how it's actually a disease. It's like, so what does this do to a person's body to be, and actually, I mean, like so part of it was like, say you're in a store and you're a black person and they're kind of just watching you to make mm-hmm. sure you, quote unquote, that you don't steal anything
mm-hmm.
or something. I mean, kind of just living with that kind of stuff, or you're a mother and you're worried about her child being shot by a gun or
mm-hmm.
something. I mean,
exactly.
That's huge. And that's the kind of stress you're saying that as a black woman you're dealing with?
Exactly. And again, not just black people deal with this. It the issue, and I think this is so very important to include, in our country, we have a very hard time with nuance.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there's a sort of cowboy mentality that we notice. You're either against me or you're with me. You see, there's no nuance. This is something else I think that if we looked at racism in a more inclusive way and began to realize that it's not just black or white, pun intended.
Right.
It's actually along lines of gray. So rather than someone coming right out and saying, oh, I hate you because you're a bad word,
mm-hmm.
right? Instead, it would be that subtle ignoring you
right.
at the checkout counter. Or that subtle, for instance, in Portland, on the way here today, I actually heard on the radio that police officers in Portland tend to stop African-American drivers 7 times higher than the rate of actual black drivers in the city, okay? So that's a subtle thing. Over time, you're going to be stopped more often. You're going to feel less comfortable driving. These are the sort of, it's a drip, drip, drip of racism every day. And I found it very interesting, right after that story, Governor Kate Brown declared addiction a public health threat. My point is, and this is a perfect example of institutional racism, why would we not declare racism a public health threat when we see this sort of disproportionate expense of the police department, for instance? You're paying for that. Everyone is paying for that.
Right. And well, let's talk about, like, so how does this stress actually affect the body? What is it doing to a person?
Well, what we know is there is a stress hormone called cortisol. And this is the sort of thing that clamps down on the blood vessels, increasing the risk for early birth, early premature birth, and low birth weight. Because when those vessels are clamped down with that cortisol, less oxygen, of course, will get to the placenta, which is what nourishes the baby. So we know that this is one of the things. It's called hypercortisolism, or low-level, chronic, unremitting, and inescapable stress. And this is how these low birth weight babies come into being far too early, before they're ready.
So it's kind of, your body's in a constant sort of fight or flight response.
Exactly.
Basically.
And it's this inability to ever fully relax. It's like driving around with a cop in your rearview mirror all the time. And you're thinking, I'm not speeding.
That is stressful.
But you're constantly looking at your speedometer.
Right.
You think, I'm not braking, but you're constantly worried about pushing on the brake too much. Or you're worried about that taillight that might be out. It's not out, but that constant worry about it.
Right.
And so we know that being pulled over by a police officer can have lethal consequences for people of color. So this constant driving and worrying about that increases, right, again, that hypercortisolism, so that you never quite all the way relax.
Right.
And it becomes very difficult to relax even at home. Even in your bed.
Right. Stephen, what was his name? Stephen Clark just
exactly.
got shot in his backyard in Sacramento.
Precisely.
Right.
And so the other thing we often hear, and I think another important way that we can flip the script, is when we hear people who are pulled over and have dire consequence, instead of thinking in our brain, well, if they just cooperated, if they just not mouthed off, if they just had their hands where they could be seen, if they just change their behavior. In our mind, if we can just change that idea to, what if the police officer had not been so terrified walking up to the car?
Right.
And I think this is something that's very important. There is a statute that says, and this is ubiquitous across the country, that if a police officer has reasonable ideas that his life is in danger from this perpetrator, potential or alleged perpetrator, then that justifies deadly force or escalating force. If we take into account that our entire narrative in this country is around the pathologizing of the black body or the underlying current of racism, then that person will have an idea of harm from that black person regardless of whether it actually exists.
Right.
So in that way, an officer will always be protected against prosecution for harming a black person because they will always have reasonable doubt or reasonable fear based on the underlying paradigm in our country.
Right.
In this way, there will be no consequence for escalating violence against black people.
So, Paul, would you like to just weigh in with something here?
I was about to ask that.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Leslie. It's such a pleasure to have you on this show. So I've only learned in the last year or two that the origins of the police force system in the United States were about slave patrols.
Yes.
I hadn't understood that until recently, and now I'm wondering, this rule that you're saying is true for the entire policing system in the United States about if a policeman has a reasonable fear for their own safety, that they can use deadly force. Do you know what the origin of that is? And does it also come directly out of racist history?
I have a strong suspicion that it does. And this is another part of the institutionality that we're speaking about. It's very easy for an institution to disguise that kind of history and use what will look like administrative or bureaucratic behavior or verbiage in these statutes. So of course you're going to want a police officer to be able to use escalating force if they have reasonable concerns. Certainly that makes sense. But when you take into account that what's quote reasonable end quote or just conditioned slash traditional fear, then that's a very nuanced definition, isn't it? If you say a person has reasonable fear, well, it's reasonable if you're raised in a culture of fear of African-American people, then of course it's going to be reasonable. Would it be reasonable in Africa or Belize Well, perhaps not. So I think these are the nuanced conversations that we tend to avoid when we're talking in these global terms, and that's why should CDC do its job and say racism is a threat to public health, we will begin to raise awareness on these issues rather than merely talking about, quote, health disparities, which sort of has a connotation of an inherent deficiency in people of color, rather than taking it in a larger context of the culture and the institution of racism, which is a system of othering.
So just as a follow-up, could you see it being a relevant step forward to remove that kind of language from the right of police
exactly
to protect themselves?
Exactly. And again,
where would that happen? At what scale of lawmaking?
Well, I think that we've had some very intelligent and scholarly people bring that into the room. So for instance, Kamara Jones, a brilliant MD, PhD, MPH, who speaks to this issue directly when she says, we need to change the conversation away from where is racism at play here to it is at play here. Let's see how we can change it, how we can undermine that system of racism. So I think that would be a place where we could start. Should CDC declare racism a threat to public health, we could begin to look at these statutes and say, look, it touches every sector of our culture, including corrections, the judicial system, these statutes, and other access to, for instance, geographical racism, where we have very low access to fresh and organic foods in some of the neighborhoods that we know. So this is a way that a more global, larger umbrella approach to discussing racism as a threat would have efficacy in the judiciary system. Lawyers, for instance, would have more awareness about how to defend their patients or their clients in court. Sorry. It's hard to get out of the medical paradigm.
I want to interrupt just quick here and say that you're tuned to the Recovery Zone. This is your non-corporate community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm on the phone with Paul Cienfuegos and in the studio with Leslie Gregory, who's founder of Right to Health, an organization that provides health outreach, education, and empowerment to people affected by stress-related risks associated with racism. And you can call in with your questions or comments. The phone here is 503-231-8187. And I just to get back to this again, so you have actually gone to the CDC. You've written them. What's been the outcome of that? You're trying to get them to declare racism a public health issue, right?
Perfect. Yes. And so there are four criteria. And all I'm saying is they're criteria. They're not a suggestion. You know, they're not guidelines. They are criteria.
Could you just say what those are?
Sure, sure. So the first criterion is that it is a burden. In other words, it's costly, human cost, whatever type of cost, it's a burden on our system. And that's absolutely true. We know that these disparities can cost billions, billions. And we have that very well documented. The second is that it's a disproportionate burden on a sector of the population. And we know that it disproportionately affects people of color.
So that was like HIV with gay people at one time?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, actually, that was another part of the flipping of that script, and we knew that
eventually we ripped that off. Back to black.
Exactly. Well, and other segments of the population. But the third is also that there is evidence that upstream change will make a difference. And we know that that's true as well. We know that it's institutional. Again, upstream means institutions need to change. We also have evidence, and that's the fourth criterion, that current measures are not enough. And that defines precisely what we're seeing with racism. And so I wrote the criterion in a letter to CDC, and I said, will you please do your job? And their response was unsatisfactory in my mind, but others have told me that they feel like it was very dismissive, because not only did they say no by de facto because they didn't change, but they also said if you'd be willing to volunteer any further interventions that you'd like to suggest, we'd be happy to entertain them. So in other words, you do for free.
You come up with
what
it.
what we're being paid to
right.
do.
And even though they do say, like, they'll say that, like, racism is a risk factor for heart disease. I mean,
exactly.
So what is the where they're saying they're not allowing? I mean, I don't even understand how come it's not considered a risk factor when it is a risk factor when they talk about it.
Exactly.
I don't, yeah.
And since after all, heart disease is the number one killer in our country, one would think.
Right. And more and more people of color are
affected by it.
Right.
Yes. And not just heart disease. What I like to say is cardiovascular disease.
Which goes back to the stress that you were talking about.
Precisely. Right. Precisely. And you see how simple it is to connect the dots for you.
Yeah.
Why would our nation's primary care provider not do that same connecting? This
Absolutely.
Is our question. Yes,
Absolutely.
And this is the systemic and institutional nature of it. I think the other piece, and a perfect example that will also help you understand, is that when we saw years ago the crack epidemic, which was disproportionately affecting people of color, right? You never heard about that. The response by these national health institutions was, we need stronger drug laws. We need more criminalization.
Or heroin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what we knew, but now, so this is the heroin issue brings another piece into the room. Now that it is an opioid overdose epidemic that much more affects white people in this country, now it is a public health issue. You see?
Right.
So this is a perfect example of how criminalization was applied to the crack epidemic, but actual care is applied to the opioid epidemic. And this is a perfect example of institutional racism. What we're saying is, if CDC would do its job and we could look at racism in a more global preventive aspect, think of the billions that we would save, And this is also another concern at this point in time because we know the current administration has a plan to gut the CDC's budget. By 7%, my understanding was. And that's a great deal of money to cut from a national preventive institution. What we're saying is, CDC, do your job. Don't let the budget be cut, but put the money where it is most likely to save billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of lives.
Right. In other words, instead of saving billions, or not even billions, mm-hmm. probably millions, by cutting the CDC, you want to save billions.
Right.
By changing some of their policies.
Perfect. And yeah. remember, it's not just the health care of Americans that will be gained here. Think about our reputation abroad. Think about the fact that we are going into other countries and saying, you need to change your human rights policies, when in this country, our hypocrisy is showing.
Yeah, exactly. And so basically, you tried to get them to change this. They didn't. I think there was like, you mentioned in the talk that you gave that I saw on your website, a Framingham study mm-hmm. that talked about heart disease but didn't even include black people in it and
exactly.
at all.
Exactly.
And then, of course, there was the syphilis study where it was all about black people and basically making them sick with it.
And withholding treatment, actually.
Withholding treatment,
that's
right.
correct.
And were these part of government studies or government policies, or how did those come about?
So I think that's another really important point. I appreciate the question. So what we know about Framingham, and one of the things that it's so important to point out is we've had several suggestions about how to fix racism that have not worked. One of them is to say, well, we need to take this research out of the public sector, put it into the private sector. And so the Framingham study was largely a public-driven research, and it went over several generations, and it's in fact still continuing. It started in 1948, and it was studying heart disease. Even now, it's used in terms of Framingham risk scores, et cetera, on how to treat, prevent, and manage heart disease. There were no black people in it, though black people disproportionately suffer from heart disease. So that was an institutional attempt at addressing heart disease. So based on that, we now know how to manage lipids, blood pressure, cholesterol, these sorts of things. That was in 1948. Even though it's continuing to study now, it was transformational in how we manage heart disease. Currently, we have a new strategy how to manage heart disease. It's a cholesterol-lowering medication that's very different from all the other statins that we know can save lives. This new study, and even though it was done in 2016-17, we were always told, wait, the old people will die out and racism will be fixed by just natural evolution.
Right.
So the new study on this new medication was done just now. Imagine what demographics you should think would be in the study now, right? We were supposed to wait.
Yes.
It's going to get better.
People of color.
96% white people.
Oh, really?
Do you really think that decades of change will show only a 4% improvement in representation? No. So this is another reason why, now that it's moved into the private sector, these studies have not improved significantly. So a 96% white rate does not instill a great deal of confidence in, for instance, a patient of color who might say, I'd like to avail myself of this drug. How much trust would you have in this study when it does not represent you?
Right.
And I actually spoke to a pharmacist who works with these, with the company that makes this new drug. And of course, the bizarre and institutional nature of racism excludes people of color from the studies. They actually tried to get more people of color in the study and were unable to find willing patients. Can you imagine why?
That goes back to the syphilis study.
Precisely. So right. You see the complex nature and the institutionality of it.
Right.
It undermines all of us.
So in a certain way, I noticed that you said racism is actually a kind of a paranoia. And it works both ways, doesn't
it? It works both ways.
Yeah.
It does not exclude anyone.
Right.
And that's the other piece. I think we should add a fifth criterion to the public health issue, is that though it affects everyone, the remedy of these public health issues can save much more than the target population. All people will be enhanced. Life for all people in this country will be enhanced if we can address the underlying cause.
Right.
And I think that's just a very important message to send back to our elected officials. Do your job. Represent all of us.
Right.
And I think that's another thing that can improve not just the public health system, but our actual systems of governance.
And Paul, are you still there?
You bet.
Yeah. Any comments on all of this?
Yeah. This is absolutely so fascinating, Leslie. So I keep reading and rereading on your website in front of me, holding the federal government responsible to take action, declaring racism a national public health crisis, and whether the President of the United States is Obama or Trump, it's hard for me to imagine that the federal government is going to shift on something that's this radical, revolutionary a change. I mean, because what you're describing would require so much structural change in the way that the whole society is organized to really deal with racism. And, you know, when you look at the whole history of mass social change movements that were successful, like suffragists and abolitionists, what you notice about really all great social movements is they start somewhere at the local and they build up.
Correct.
They build power local, then state, then federal.
Yes.
And you're starting federally, and I know that you know that I do work around community rights and building power from the local up to take on government and corporate malfeasance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I keep wondering what it would look like, and I'd love to maybe have a long lunch with you about this in the near future, is what would declaring racism a national, a local public health crisis look like as a locally enforceable ballot initiative that Portland or Multnomah County would pass? That could be directly locally enforced. You wouldn't have to worry about intransigent politicians.
I agree.
Have you thought about actual specific steps that would be changed in the law if you made racism a national, a local public health crisis, a local ordinance?
Yes, I have. In fact, we met with the county health department and some of the community health workers. The concept was very well received, but I think one of the things that was so striking about that conversation was that there was the local MPHs, Masters of Public Health is what most of the people involved in this work have. It was very interesting because one of the things we heard was that it would be pointless to just, quote, make a declaration as an empty sort of thing. There are several declarations that have been made, and the argument was that just to make another declaration would not be helpful. And I think one of the things that we find with this sort of argument is that it undermines a couple of things and ignores a couple of things. Number one, if you were a person of color in Portland, for instance, where the population is incredibly low at only 4%, we are ignoring the possible mental health improving aspects of it just to hear that someone cares, just to hear that your public health officials recognize this ubiquitous, inescapable low-level stress. So I think that we forget that incredibly important step. I think the next thing I would look at is to say, yes, if we declared a public health risk in Portland alone, then at the very least we can begin to look at some of these larger systemic issues like the gentrification of Northeast and begin to initiate resolutions and steps to actually regain some of the ground that was lost in that regard. So for instance, where we would have public health outreach efforts in Northeast before the gentrification happened, and we could address a large percent of the population. Now we know, since we've had a second diaspora and we've broken up the Northeast population, we need to actually go out and get patients who need this screening, heart disease risk, things like that. We could actually begin to go out into outlying communities where they've had to move. So I think that's an excellent strategy that could be used around the country. Rather than expecting people of color to come to conventional medical care, we actually have prototypes from my hometown in Ohio that showed tremendous efficacy by going out into communities and actually seeking out and screening individuals where they live.
Outreach.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's another thing that Right to Health is offering. And that's another fundraising goal for us.
That's so excellent.
A follow-up question. Are there explicitly racist structures of law or explicitly racist laws at the local or county level that could be gotten rid of through local ordinance writing?
I believe that there could be, but I have to say, number one, my main focus is medicine, and yeah. So I'm not particularly eloquent to speak on those issues. However, and this is another thing that Right to Health has been offering, to be a clearinghouse for all these siloed organizations that are working in anti-racism. And there are many. Quite frankly, we have some tremendously successful parts of the puzzle being put together now with housing rights, with homelessness, with some of these organizations that are doing outreach like CAP, the AIDS Project. We have some tremendous, brilliant interventionists in our public health system, particularly the STD clinic at Multnomah County Health Department, doing some tremendous work in outreach. What Right to Health is saying is if we have a clearinghouse, which should be, again, the job of CDC, to connect all these anti-racist and interventions together so that we're not all working in these silos. Again, that goes to the institutionality of it. Where a person like me who's doing medical work could actually be in close connection with people doing housing justice, doing gentrification outreach, doing these things, then our more large picture umbrella approach would be more effective, and that's how institutionality undermines us. So I think you're absolutely right, Paul, when you speak about the pieces of this puzzle, including everything like those underlying structures of governance. And also, I have to say, there are traditional, not necessarily legislated, but traditional marginalizing aspects of our culture. Just on a personal basis, on a city, county, local, state basis, that just exist, like the previous legislation in Oregon until the 40s, where people of color were actually forbidden by law to purchase land. These are some of the things that would be, that have been changing slowly. Again, we do acknowledge that there are changes. It's just that it's so slowly. And I think that's the other place where institutions have the benefit of outlasting people Yeah. You know, people will die as well, but institutions will sustain, and that's how institutionality undermines us.
I'm going to just...
Could you give folks your website? Because I realize you haven't throughout the whole period.
Oh, right. We should do that.
So, yes, it's righttohealthus.org, and that's a number two.
Yeah, the number two, righttohealthus, number two.
Right.
And just to let people know, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, your non-corporate community radio station. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I'm Stephanie Potter. I'm on the phone with community rights activist Paul Cienfuegos and in the studio with physician, assistant, and social justice activist Leslie Gregory, who founded Right to Health, right with a number two, Health U.S., to address stress-related racism, or the stress related to racism. And this gets back to, you know, like you just mentioned, those laws that were on the books in mm-hmm. Portland. And as Paul was saying, if the CDC or the U.S. government isn't doing it, there's this whole thing. I just saw that Australia had a We're Sorry Day.
That's right.
They did this in 2008. Every year, there's this huge thing about they're just sorry to what they did to the Aborigines, how they mm-hmm. dragged them from their homes and they basically beat them and impoverished them and blah, blah, blah. And maybe if... The U.S. isn't going to do that. And I think the U.S. did have some kind of obscure apology at some point.
Yes, it was the House of Representatives actually wrote it into the an amendment to the Constitution, actually. Or I don't know that it was an amendment, but it was it was written into the public record,
uh-huh.
an apology. But you never heard anything about it.
No.
And it was in 2008.
Yeah,
and it
was fairly obscure. Australia did it, and it was a big deal.
It was big, yeah. Exactly.
And so maybe what you're saying and what Paul was just saying, what if Portland had a We're Sorry kind
That's
of thing?
Absolutely. That's an interesting piece.
I mean, because it just seems like... Oh, and by the way, if listeners want to call in, the number here is 503-231-8183. 87, sorry, 231-8187.
There you go. Yes, happy
anyway,
to take questions.
So reparations, that really intrigues me. And I ran into a lot of stuff about, so the government isn't doing reparations.
No,
really,
it
at
isn't.
All, right?
Not at all.
But there are these groups, like there's something in the Bay Area mm-hmm. where people are donating so that people of color who are being paroled for life sentences have a place to stay, and
That's
this
right.
is a way to, you know, reparate. There's another place called, what was it? It's some kind of map thing. Where is this? Anyway, you plug into it, and you give money to specific people who need money.
That's right.
Like, you have a black farm you're trying to start, like, in Alabama, mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. I mean, let me see if I can find this here.
There are communities that are creating voluntary taxes
That's right.
towards indigenous people, given that we've been on stolen land for generations.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And there are steps. There are small steps. But I think, again, this is where we see these silos of small pockets of people doing
right.
this work. And this is, again, where we're saying if we take a systemic approach, then we can connect all these separate little silos to create a net across the entire country of people who are actually being heard on these matters. And I think it's critically important that we do so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And basically what you're asking is that the government really just get involved in
just
this.
Just do its job.
Just do its
That's
job.
That's exactly right. This is not a guideline.
Right.
These four criteria are actually criteria.
Right.
They've been met. And they are a perfect example of institutional racism.
And
every day it's not done.
It happened with the Disabilities Act.
Exactly.
It happened with all the work that was done to, you know, deal with AIDS.
Right, and smoking.
HIV.
So
smoking.
I think that's a brilliant piece. That's another great analogy. Instead of looking at lung cancer, we're saying look at the tobacco that's causing it. And I think the other part of the analogy that's particularly important here is, just like tobacco, when we chase the money, we saw that there were huge money interests undermining that effort.
Ah.
And that's the other piece that I think when we're talking about institutional racism and public health threats, etc., if we track the money, we see that this is a manipulative issue behind the
could
picture.
Could you say, for instance, that the prison industry, because there is a for-profit industry...
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
If we strip away some of the blindness around this institutionality, we'll see there's moneyed interest behind it. Absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. And again, this is how it affects everyone. You're paying
right
these institutions to incarcerate our people.
Right.
You see? And so think of the money we would save and we could put toward more appropriate things like child and infant health care. Okay? Health care for all Americans.
Sensible stuff.
You know, common sense stuff like
and
that.
And maybe even the NRA wants to keep racism going, because I remember the Michael Moore film about our problem with guns.
Exactly.
A lot of it is about racism in the U.S.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Fear.
Yeah.
It's about fear.
And back to paranoia again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just think the other piece is, we know that gun violence is very costly in this country. And do you know, CDC was at one point empowered to study gun violence, but just as they got the mandate, what happened? It's amazing. The funding was yanked.
Right.
So that they could not study gun violence. So again, we want to track that money and understand this is not by accident. Okay? It's by design. And so I think it's important that, and I appreciate Paul's bringing that up, because I think the local measures are absolutely critical. I would call on Kate Brown. If you're able to declare this opioid overdose epidemic as a public health threat in Portland, think about what else is going on in Portland as a unique example for the entire country. I think we're in a unique position to say to the country, follow our example. We know what we're doing. We see what is happening to people of color in this country, in this city, and in this state. Let us be the example for the rest of the country. We have interventions that work. Let us show you.
Well, you know, and then it just gets to me like, okay, so we have this racism. We've had it since slaves were brought to America.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like from, you know, the 1700s.
That's correct.
And so it goes, and as you say on your website, it goes from parents, you know,
raise their children,
grow up and they have their children. How do you stop this? How do you stop this crazy paranoid stuff being transmitted from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I think we do have interventions. I think the poignant part of it for me is that my mother had a prototype in Northwest Ohio that worked absolutely brilliantly to reduce these barriers. It was a public and a portable unit that went out into the communities and pulled patients in, pulled people in, and engaged them in their own health care. That was one part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things that just was so interesting to me as we move forward through this process is to know that it's largely Black women who have carried this burden of watching our children, having early deliveries of premature babies. And I think this is one of the things that we can do. We need to give the mic back to the people who've been doing this work. And it's largely Black women. And I think that's a big part of one of the institutional changes I'd like to see. We know that politically, Black women have a power that is coming back now with the Moore election in Alabama, where that would have been a tremendous loss, and we saw large mobilization. So my point is, we do have these interventions. We have a brilliant midwife here in Portland, Shafia Monroe, who is doing tremendous work to reduce the very phenomenon you're talking about, these low birth weight babies. So we have, again, pockets of strategies to address these issues, but we need the underlying institutions to do their job, to connect these dots and make it a more ubiquitous strategy, just like the ubiquitous nature that undermines the health of all of us.
Right, right.
And so I think that's one of the steps, but there are so very many. And all we're asking is our CDC to be responsive to those individuals who are doing this work around the country. We also have a social media drive where people are being driven into some of these community groups locally and nationally, on public media, on social media, that helps people connect with healing factors. For instance, a racial healing collective of women of color who are doing this, a psychiatrist, an ecumenical leader, who actually invites people to their virtual forum to help strategize local measures for each individual who comes to the forum. Just to say, I know this is an issue for me. Here are some ways you can mitigate it. And so we have brilliant people with heart and compassion working on this issue. We just need to give the mic to them, the resources to them, the time to them to do their job, because they're out there and we're in touch with them. They hit me up on social media all the time.
And so this is, and what you're talking about here is like how people of color can get help, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And white people. I really can't
stress
enough.
See, I want to get back to that.
Yeah, I can't stress enough.
As a white woman here.
Yeah. Well, we know that, you know, so here's the paradigm shift we need to make. When black people are afraid and paranoid and harmed by this, we run, we collect, and we try to save each other. When white people get paranoid and fearful around this, they hurt black people.
Yeah.
So it's important to understand. And then we know that those individuals who may unintentionally be perpetrating suffer with the guilt of that for years and years to come, too. And this all increases health risk. So I think it's critically important that we flip that script. It is not just hurting black people. It is hurting white people, who in turn may unintentionally hurt black people as well. So it's critically important to remember, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And even though it's called racism in this moment, it's really, I'd like to use the word othering, because racism has just another big flare up to it. You know, you use that word and immediately people become fragile around
it. Hey, I'm not a racist.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. So we're trying to change that paradigm as well, and we're calling it othering.
But when I do this, I'm harming somebody.
I'm harming someone, that's right. Even tacitly,
so just
even
to sort
unintentionally.
Of keep really finding out what those things are.
And that's right.
Yeah, KBOO actually has a beloved community thing going on
here.
Where we have these monthly meetings and we try to like address this. And it's pretty powerful.
It is
good.
Healing is always powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be more powerful even than the harming.
Yeah.
And that's what we're promoting at Right to Health. It's healing versus harming. And I think the other piece, and this is another thing that was so important about your question about what we can do. And I think one of the things that I've been learning, even about my own mother as she is close to the end of her life, is that a tremendous amount of her time in working on this protocol was spent calming the fears of white people just in order to do the funding, do the outreach, get the work and the collaboration among communities. A disproportionate amount of her time and effort was spent in assuring white people that this does not mean we're going to take away your privilege. And just like we're doing with the gun work right now, we're trying to get people to understand we're not trying to take away your guns. We're just trying to make sure they don't harm more people.
Right. We don't want to get shot anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that is the gun rights activism is another really perfect analogy to what we're seeing with racism. It is not anti-you. It is just protective of us. And that's all it is. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing with the Black Lives Matter movement. There's such a sort of fear and pushback against them because it feels like it's against white people.
Right.
This is, again, that cowboy mentality. It is not on or off. It's and. It's not either or. It's and. So it's not about Black Lives Matter to the exclusion of white lives. No. The point is, all lives won't matter until Black Lives Matter. And I think that's the way we need to be phrasing it, to keep this sort of fear at bay. I understand how it feels to worry that your privilege will be disrupted. Our point is not about that. It is about inclusion and compassion. If we can't do this job, if we can't do these, make these changes with love and compassion for all of our people, then we will be no better than those who perpetrated against us. And that is not our intent by any means.
Just to stop that a minute, and we're tuned to the Recovery Zone on your non-corporate community radio station, KBOO Portland, KBOO, on the phone with Paul Cienfuegos in the studio with Leslie Gregory. She's founder of Right to Health, an organization that provides health outreach, education, and empowerment to people affected by stress-related risks associated with racism. You can call in with your questions or comments, 503-231-8187. And Paul, did you have anything else you wanted to ask or add to that?
I did, but I'm also kind of surprised that this fascinating conversation isn't bringing lots of callers. I wanted to remind people that Leslie's website is righttohealthus.org, and it's right2healthus.org.
Thanks,
I'm
Paul.
Wondering whether Is it just as essential, and I'm not trying to take us off this topic at all, but just curious what your thought is about this. Is it just as essential that we declare sexism a national public health crisis and classism, et cetera, or is there something unique about racism?
Well, yeah, I think, first of all, that's a great question. And at the end of the day, yes, I would like to see othering as a problem and focused on. But I think the first part of your question is quite relevant. I've had people ask me this before. So sexism, classism, these other types of marginalization, while they are critically important, I believe, racism is the only one that our government has actually taken responsibility for and apologized for. So I think that's the piece that is most unique about racism. We know that the U.S. government is directly responsible for racism and the fact that it was the way our country was actually founded. You know, Condoleezza Rice made a brilliant comment. She said the United States was born with a birth defect called slavery. And I love the fact that people are using these analogies that relate to health so eloquently and so often. You know, Trevor Noah also did the same when he was interviewed by Whoopi Goldberg on The View. He said the same was true with smokers, how we used to say, oh, you're a smoker, get out of here. And then when we brought them into the fold and said these people need help, we realized that and we saw such a big change. And I think that's exactly the point. As a health risk, racism has direct relationship and has been apologized for. That's the difference between the other types of othering. You know, the United States has never really apologized for sexism or classism.
Maybe it's time.
Or these other things. And so I think by starting with racism, we'll get a much larger effective for the money, bang mm-hmm. for your buck, if you will. But I agree, and I think that what we can learn from racism, if we declare it a threat to public health, we can apply to other things. And we'll know that, again, as a marginalized populace, you can see that gay people may feel disproportionately targeted and have some of the same health effects. But I think starting with racism, because it's been more directly impacted by government policy, policing, these sorts of things, I think it's more appropriate to start with racism.
We do have a caller. Jeff, what would you like to add or say?
Say that you were talking in general about health, and then you referred to Native peoples. And I know that in at least one of the Native languages, that health is a verb, not a noun.
I love that. I love that.
That was it. That's all I had to say.
Okay.
No, I love that. It actually is a practice. And again, I think this is exactly what we've been talking about. Health is a practice. And so this is what we're asking CDC to do, is enhance the practice of all Americans to be healthier and address this phenomenon of othering. Just another issue, though, that I would bring up. When we're talking about disparities, it would not be appropriate to omit the incredible health disparities that we're seeing in another important community of color, which is our Native population. I think that a collaboration between our Native population and the people of color in African American populations as the two most targeted by these institutional policies, it's critically important. I do believe that Natives and Blacks need to work very closely together on this issue because we're disproportionately targeted. For instance, not just by the health system, but by our judicial system. And those of you who have forgotten, please let me bring Leonard Peltier into the room. That gentleman is still languishing in prison. And I think that's another big piece that we need to be looking at. These disproportionate targeting and over-sentencing recommendations.
Right.
This is another thing. I have to say, too, I believe that the Innocence Project is another target where if we declare racism a threat to public health, we can drive some of that funding into the Innocence Project. We know that so many people of color have been released because now that DNA is available to exonerate so many of our people of color who are in prison. I think that's another big piece that could start the healing. And again, when we talk about reparations, I'm always very concerned about using that word because I don't think you can repair something that's continually to be broken.
It's still going on.
Yes,
right.
It's still being broken. How do you repair?
Right.
So I think we need to stop the continuing damage as well as repair.
Right.
So I just think that's a critical piece.
Right. Just one tiny thing in that. Like, it's not even just the jails. It's the schools. I read
this. Oh, absolutely. The school-to-prison pipeline is insane.
Black preschool children are 3.5 times more likely than their white counterparts to receive out-of-school suspensions. Preschool kids. We have one more caller. And there's more that goes on with, you know, suspensions for Black kids in K-12 and on and on.
That's exactly right.
Black girls in particular, 7 times more likely to be suspended and 4 times more likely to be arrested than white girls.
Right.
There's something off there.
That's right.
Who's the caller? Alex? And please ask your question quickly. We're almost out of time. We have like 5 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, hi. I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm a community health worker from a city not too far away from Portland. I work mainly with the Latinx population here. And I work with youth that are at risk as well, that are on the prison pipeline. And it's actually something very, very hard to work with, especially when the school district is not on the same page with all this new information and empowerment of people of color. So a lot of times when we educate our youth on prison pipeline issues, they go to school and then they ask questions. It's not met with a very friendly attitude from their teachers. So a lot of times we're in a position where there's a lot of information, but it doesn't reach. There's a lot of information, new information today about race and health and how it affects us, but it's not being heard. It's not being used in the right areas, which are like schools. School counselors or alternative schools, they are still like in the dark ages when it comes to these things that are not even controversial anymore. There are facts that there is a prison pipeline.
Okay.
So that's one of the barriers that we've had.
Alex, I want to get back to Leslie because we really just have 5 minutes, and I want her to also be able to say what you offer, the things that you're offering too.
I love that, Alex, because you're absolutely right. Please contact your school boards and ask for our community organization to come into your community and help to train. That's a big part of what we do. We also partner with for-profit organizations here in the city to help to educate about that, because there is something that can be done. So, Alex, please request of our group to come into your communities and do our education. This is a tremendous problem, and we can help to reduce what we're calling ACEs, which is these adverse childhood events which put these children at very high risk for chronic adult diseases. So hit us up. We're happy to come and help with that exact thing. And thank you so much for that question.
And you offer racial equity and health workshops?
Yes, we do.
And mobile that's what unit we can do. Health screenings?
That's exactly right.
Data gathering and R&D, research and development around racial equity and health? Anything you wanted to say about
yes,
any of that?
That's exactly what we do, is we target these specific populations and address these specific problems, just like Alex is bringing up, so we can train these teachers on how to answer the questions more appropriately and bring these children into the center of their communities rather than marginalizing them with these dismissive answers. Alex, please ask for our help. That's exactly what we do.
Oh, God. One more call. Dave, you got 10 seconds. Dave?
On the question of white supremacy and systemic racism, we have to go to the core of that. I'm African American. I have 2 cousins in law enforcement. And I told them a long time ago, the way to end this is we need to get every black family to have one person in law enforcement for at least 20 years. Thank you.
Okay, great, what do you say great to that, question. Leslie?
Well, that's a great question. So here's my point. We do not feel comfortable in this country criticizing our heroes, and that has been a big problem. Police, fire, paramilitary organizations like state troopers, etc. These are some of the most racist of our organizations. Because why? Because they have to trust each other. Because they are brotherhoods, the firefighters, etc. They have a very close bond. And so with the closeness of that bond, you have more marginalization of special populations. You are absolutely right, but we need to protect our police and fire from the damage that racism does. And it's another thing our community group offers, is training to these paramilitary organizations so they understand what it means to marginalize their own brothers. My father was a firefighter, and he told us of stories. He would come home and his fellow firefighters made terrible comments to him and increased his own stress. What if we found out this was a big part of why firefighters number one cause of death is not smoke inhalation, not fire. It's heart disease. And so I think it's very critical to address these things in our paramilitary organizations. And we do that too. So please ask for Right to Health to come into your organization and do more trainings around this, because we can help save lives of our local heroes.
And Right to Health, right, the number two, healthus.org. Yeah. Okay. Leslie, it's been great having you.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Paul for being on the telephone with us. You've been hearing from Leslie Gregory, founder of Right to Health, who's working to address the health risks associated with racism. We've been on the phone with community rights activist Paul Cienfuegos.
Hey, Paul.
Has been The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. And thank you to Tammy Dean for her fine engineering. And thank you for listening and supporting KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Great show. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Leslie.
Really, that's awesome. Good job.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Join rubab master Humayun Saki for his first performance in Oregon and sitarist Josh Feinberg for short solo sets. Then they will play a set together in the second half of the concert. Refreshments and concessions will be served. Again, that's Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. In local news, an audit of the Portland Police Gang Enforcement Unit has found that the unit has disproportionately targeted African Americans in the city. According to the audit,